This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge. When Craig McLaughlin was born with hemophilia, the doctor gave him 12 years to live. His inability to stop bleeding if injured didn't fare well when Craig moved as a teenager to his stepfather's exotic farm in Pittsburgh. On the farm were chimpanzees, jaguars, tigers, causing danger for a hemophiliac at every turn. Despite bumps in the road, Craig has stayed resilient through life. His new memoir, Passing on Curves While Death Rides Shotgun, is a collection of essays and includes stories as a hemophiliac on the tiger farm, where Craig eventually realized the animals weren't his only threat. Craig will read from the memoir tonight at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro, but first joins us in the studio. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you.
When did you first start writing down these stories?
I started writing, it would have been about 95, 96, because at that point I thought I was going to die of HIV, and I wanted my daughter to have that history. I wanted her to have my stories.
You've hundreds and hundreds of pages of stories and memoirs, but you've whittled this down in this kind of memoir to a bunch of essays. The primary purpose, though, isn't really for them to just be read, but it's also for them to be heard on stage. Why write these stories, kind of meaning for them to be performed?
Well, I'm a storyteller. I love storytelling. I love being on stage. I've got a little bit of acting experience. And so I went back into this very lengthy, cumbersome memoir and sort of pillaged it for the stories that could be done in shorter ways. And then I've told them over time, and then I decided I could sort of reassemble them in a much easier read, a much more convenient book. So that's the genesis was really the onstage performances.
Exotic animals lend themselves very well for storytelling.
Yes,
you have rich material to work with.
Yeah, people love tigers and so forth.
So. You open up in your memoir with a story about your birth that shows that pain was a part of your life from the start. You say about the disorder, boundaries are a luxury I could not afford. Will you tell us a little bit about hemophilia and how you coped with that at an early age? And again, this is a disease which basically means your blood can't clot. You can't stop bleeding once
right.
you start.
It doesn't clot well enough. So it's mostly bruises and swelling in the joint and that kind of stuff. So, it's hard to remember like that memory that starts the book. People don't really form memories, concrete memories that are like images at that age. They often can remember impressions. So I have a little bit of trouble saying up until about 4 or 5 exactly how it shaped me, but I know it shaped me. And so part of my life has been unpacking the way I created this Craig that could walk around the world, that could pass for normal, at least tried to do that. So it very fun. The pain shaped my character, the way I was dealt with by other people, including the medical profession, shaped my character, my ability to belong into groups, being picked last for the baseball teams, that kind of thing.
What was treatment like for hemophiliacs when you were a child?
Well, the treatment when I was a child was just putting whole blood or plasma in. And the problem with that is as your body got bigger, eventually you couldn't put enough in to control the bleeding, which is why the life expectancy of 12 years. And I don't know what they told my parents. I just found that in an encyclopedia, and I went and checked, and it was published at the year of my birth. So that was the statistical belief at that age.
And you detail really just an amazing amount of injuries that you would have. And the ramifications of that would mean trip to the hospitals and things that, you know, just you wouldn't stop bleeding.
Right. And, for example, in 9th grade, I spent about a third of the year in the hospital for various things. They have over time figured out how to control the bleeding. But in those days, it meant going to the hospital. It meant spending days in the hospital. It meant spending days at home in bed and then on crutches. So,
do you feel like your parents treated you differently because there was this fear that you were made out of glass, that you couldn't be hurt, you couldn't be touched? It was too risky.
Well, my sister still talks about, or I don't know if she talks about it, but she used to complain that she didn't think it was fair that my parents didn't let her hit me. My parents actually, I think, struck a pretty good balance. A lot of hemophiliacs are so overprotected, so sheltered, that they, their joints don't develop any strength. They're easier to injure because they're not fit. And my parents let me do a lot of stuff, but I also fought for that right, teaching myself to ride a bike when I wasn't allowed to do that, those kinds of things.
When you were a teenager, you moved to a tiger farm in Pittsburgh, an exotic animal farm. How did you end up there?
Yeah, no, I suddenly went from not being able to ride a bike to actually walking into cages with tigers. But my mother, my parents divorced, and my mother ended up remarrying this person named Mike Blyman, who's actually pretty well known in the area. And he was at that point starting to collect exotic animals. It wasn't a facility. It wasn't a nonprofit. It was just this guy that liked to have tigers and jaguars and so forth. And eventually I moved to the farm, and it was much more interesting than my home.
So when you got there, I assume maybe you would had a dog or a cat growing up like most of us. You were living with – what animals were there when you arrived?
There was a tiger named Gretchen, the very first big cat. There was a jaguar named Gregor. There were llamas. There were guanacos, which are the wild ancestors of llamas. There was a very dangerous large bird called a rhea, which is very similar to an ostrich or an emu. There were spider monkeys. It was the sort of beginning of his collection, but he began to collect very fast after that. But when I got there, there were also exotic birds and things like that.
And were these animals in cages away from you in the backyard, or were they roaming? Were they roaming around?
Well, Gretchen roamed around until she got too big, which was actually pretty big by most standards. And he built a cage for her, and then he went and got Gregor. And Gregor roamed around until he broke an antique vase in the house. And then he was chained to a tree outside because we didn't have a cage. So you could not walk into our house with groceries without being attacked by a jaguar.
A jaguar is a beautiful animal, isn't it?
Gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous, yeah.
The tiger farm is now what's known as the Carolina Tiger Rescue. How did Mike, your stepfather, grow the farm from this early days, this kind of crazy menagerie of animals, into what it is now, into this mission?
Yeah, well, Mike lost tenure and was kind of looking for a way to sustain himself, and he went through at least two different nonprofits that he created, slightly different missions, and one of them was Carnivore Preservation Trust. And his original idea was this would allow people to support the tigers. They could sponsor a tiger, and also he could do certain kinds of research, particularly into animals that were going extinct. So, for example, he had the last of the Barbados leopards on the earth.
And was he, what do you think that it is that changed him from kind of just having these ideas that he'd like to be around these animals, saying, I can actually do something good here?
Well, he did love animals, and so doing something good with animals was a major drive of his. He was extremely smart. I mean, I've heard 180 IQ, and I would certainly believe that. So as he was trying to think about ways to do this, but it was also kind of a way of supporting his habit. And over time, the Carnivore Preservation Trust started doing a lot. It had facilities in Cambodia, for example. And so it became sort of an international place that was trying to reestablish certain kinds of animals, which itself was very controversial.
Before he was doing these good works and he was just kind of housing these animals, and you were there as a hemophiliac, moving to a place with tigers and jaguars roaming around. How did you live on a farm with not just these wild animals that could get you, but also just having to be around cages and, I assume, like chores, helping out with these animals?
Yeah, it wasn't unusual for me to be climbing a couple of stories up on a rickety structure in order to hang chain link fence. Whenever I was in a bad mood, I would take the Willie's Jeep and race into the back pasture and cut down a tree and cut it all into firewood with a chainsaw. And these were activities that normally people would have been frowning on for a hemophiliac. I was actually badly injured, not by the tigers, but by a llama. A llama ran up my backside and blew out my knee because my dog was chasing it. I happened to be stuck between two barns, and the llama had no place to go. And then I slipped with an 8-foot boa constrictor around my neck and re-injured that same knee. So I now have an artificial knee, largely because of a llama and a boa constrictor. The tigers and jaguars never hurt me.
But this must have been incredibly freeing for you, for a boy who had been told he had to be so careful and to now be thrown into really the thick of it.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, just building the cages, I felt like I had a purpose. I felt like I could do things. And I also felt like I sort of had a new identity. My identity had been bleeder boy. People saw me as the person with hemophiliac. They identified me that way, and I sort of structured my life around that issue. And then all of a sudden, I'm Tiger Boy, right? Very, very different experience. And that was one of the things that made the farm most valuable to me.
There's a story of the first, one of the first warm nights when you were on the farm. You slept through their window open, and you woke up to an unexpected guest. Tell us that story.
Yeah, as I already mentioned, Gregor the Jaguar had broken a vase, had been tied to a tree outside, big live oak on the entrance to the main house there. And one night, I have gone to sleep with my dog, very large dog, at the foot of my bed. And he often slept there and disturbed me. And all of a sudden, it felt a little different. I woke up and I looked down and there was Gregor. It turns out that his chain was long enough for him to jump through the window and onto my bed, which was next to the window. Something I hadn't realized. And I noticed that my ankle is wet and I looked down at the bed and he's chewed a hole in the bedspread. He's starting to work on the blanket, and the sheet underneath that is wet with jaguar drool, and directly under that is my ankle, which by now is also wet. And I look up at him, and he's just yawning, and he's got these big canine teeth, and I'm convinced he's laughing at me. And I kind of shoo him away, and he jumps out the window, and I close the window, and my dog comes back in the bed, and that was sort of the end of it. But I really believe to this day he wanted to show me what he could do if he wanted.
Do you think he would have gone all the way to the skin?
No, I don't think so. I think because I'd been involved with raising him as a from a cub on, I don't doubt.
He was just saying you can chain me up, but
I'm not sure what he was doing. I think when I woke up, though, I really got the sense he was laughing.
There was this run-in with the jaguar, but there were also a lot of other kind of run-ins with rather dangerous animals. One day, Mike brings home Lolita, who's a chimp. Who we talk about Lolita?
Yeah, well, Lolita was a. Part of a menagerie at Cook's Buffalo Ranch, which was then in Concord. And Mike bought Lolita, and he took us down to pick her up and decided that he would bring her back in the cab of the truck. Now, most people don't realize how big and strong full-grown chimpanzees are. They might see Bedtime for Bonzo or the old Tarzan series, and they think they're kind of cute. This animal is bigger than me and incredibly powerful. And we're driving back, and she's picking apart the truck. She's dismantling the truck, and one of the workers that was helping us decided he was going to be safer by putting on his motorcycle helmet. And Lolita immediately is banging on his head. And I'm sitting next to him, convinced she'll get bored with banging on him and start banging on my head. And, of course, the easiest way, the best way to kill somebody with hemophilia is to hit him over the head and start a cranial bleeding. So the whole way back from Concord, practically, I'm convinced I'm going to be dead. We later find out that Lolita had made it to Cook's Buffalo Ranch because she hated riding on the back of her previous owner's motorcycle. And in fact, if the helper had not put on his motorcycle helmet, she never would have started beating on him, and I was never at risk. She also later practically bit Mike's thumb off because she was kept in this small, tiny, I think it was a form of animal abuse looking back on it, this tiny cage. She didn't want to go back in it. Mike was trying to drag her back in it by this chain around her neck, and she bit him.
I would have bit him, too.
Any treatment like that for a human being, they would have fought back. Yeah. So I have no concerns that she did the wrong thing, frankly, considering how she was abused.
Yeah, I mean, you're living in this world where you finally, they've got the pads off of you and you're with tigers and you're running around. But you start to see that Mike, this guy who seems fun to be around, there are things going on here which are not exactly right. There are some abusive practices. What starts to happen and what do you start to realize?
Well, I think the biggest issue for me was Mike had a very violent streak, particularly at that time. And so a classic story is this beautiful Irish wolfhound was walking by him as he was walking out of the house and took a snap at his breakfast, which was a turkey drumstick. And Mike turned around and kicked the dog to shoo him away. And Mike was so powerful with a couple of black belts, he hit the dog right over the heart. And the dog didn't take another step, just turned over. And there was also some domestic violence at the house. There was road rages and all that kind of stuff. And at one point, when he and my mother were fighting, he told me to get out of the house if I knew what was good for me. And I had images of this wolfhound. I basically believed that he would never intentionally hurt me, but in one of his rages, I was at risk.
What do you do with all of this? I mean, you're a teenager. You go to college. You move out. How are you able to process kind of moving away, but remembering and seeing all that you had?
Well, I think I was kind of a brat in college. And, you know, I develop all these layers of personality to deal with this, with being in an unsafe place, with having hemophilia, with feeling a great deal of shame as a kid. And it really took me years and years to start unpacking this. And part of the book is the ability to look back as someone older who has done a lot of sort of therapeutic work, often by myself, but still thinking about these things and being able to unpack that notion of how shame shapes us, how responses to violence shape us, and how we create this person. I think we all do this to walk around in the world. We, you know, Freud would have called it the ego, but, you know, it's this self that we create in response to who we are. And as we get older, or what we have to deal with, our environment, as we go to older, we have the chance of kind of unpacking that and get a little closer to our truer selves.
I mean, you didn't just struggle with hemophilia. You also contracted HIV, you know, just add on to, because you haven't had enough.
And hepatitis C, which wasn't in the book. Yeah, a couple of years ago, they thought I was dying from liver damage, so.
You talk about this wonderful thing, very stark but fantastic in just the realness of it, of when you wanted to have a child with your wife, that you stayed at home. You said, you know what, maybe a 4 or 5 years, I can take care of her until she goes to school.
Yeah, I actually I was the stay-at-home parent for just a year, and then we were able to go to childcare. But the thing that we talked about, my wife and I, was whether she was comfortable being a single parent and when it became financially easier for her to actually support a kid, which was when the kid could go to school and cut down daycare costs. So we really thought, the question for us is, could I live another 5 years?
You'd save a lot of money.
Yeah.
you saw Mike, going back to the time. I mean, you didn't just kind of turn your back and say, wait, I see now that there was a lot of stuff going on here that wasn't exactly right. I'm done with this. You continued to visit Mike.
Yeah, I have a habit of doing that with people in my life that other people write off. And part of the book, I hope, comes through is this notion both of resilience but also compassion. Mike did a lot of egregious things, and yet I continued to visit him. And one of the things that went on is I said that he had abused my mother. One of the things that happened as he got older in life was that he started working as a counselor of men who abuse. This is not uncommon. This is peer counseling, just like, you know, most of the drug and alcohol counselors are people that have had habits. So, you know, he did make changes in his life. His situation got better. He was always open to me. And I suppose I had reasons to hate him because of some of the things we went through. But he was also, in a way, a person that freed me, a person that saw me in a way that nobody else had, as a full-grown, near adult who had a lot of capacity that wasn't being recognized.
Who let you get on top of a tiger cage.
Yes.
You'd still be kind of just skirting around on a little bicycle.
Yeah.
If it weren't for him saying, get out there and help.
Yeah.
My guest is Craig McLaughlin. His new memoir is called Passing on Curves While Death Rides Shotgun. Craig will be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro tonight at 7 p.m. sharing stories from his book. You can find out more about Craig's stories at our website, stateofthings.org. Craig, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, Pam Howland combines the classical music of Chopin with the Beatles.